Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, happy to be sitting in for Larry Mueller and talking about Wisconsin's herptiles. They are our amphibians and reptiles, and we have two experts from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources here to tell us all about them. Rory Pulaski is a conservation biologist with the DNR, and she works with herptiles in general and has particular knowledge of Wisconsin's reptiles. Rory, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
And Tara Bergeson is a conservation biologist also with the DNR, and she works especially with Wisconsin's amphibians. So great to have you with us, Tara.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So let's start out first with a definition. Tara, what is a herptile?
Well, the herptiles include our frogs and toads, salamanders, and the frogs and toads are our amphibians, mm-hmm. and the reptiles include the snakes, lizards, and turtles.
So lizards count as reptiles. Huh. Mm-hmm. I was putting them in the other category. So see there, I learned something already. And Tara, how do reptiles and amphibians differ from each other?
Well, I can tell you about the amphibian end of things. So when we think of amphibians, we think of the frogs and salamanders. And the frogs generally have, more of moist skin, although our toad doesn't. He has a more bumpy, warty skin.
Okay.
And the salamanders, sometimes I think maybe people could think that a salamander looks like a lizard. They've got the four legs and the tail and kind of crawl along. And the reptiles, I'm going to let Rory talk reptiles.
So what makes a reptile a reptile?
Well, the reptiles in general, you think of, like Tara had mentioned, the salamanders and the frogs are typically more moist skin. They typically live in more wetland environments. Mm-hmm. The reptiles are turtles, snakes, and lizards can handle much drier environments. Most of those species, the lizards and the snakes, have scales. The lizards differ from snakes in that they have eyelids. We have a legless lizard in Wisconsin, so it looks quite a bit like
a
snake.
See, I was about to say, and they have legs, but that wouldn't have been right.
No, they don't.
And turtles are also in the reptile category.
Yes, turtles are the reptiles as well.
Okay.
Yep, so they're typically, obviously a lot of those need to be, most of our species in Wisconsin of turtles need to be in the water at some point in their life, but we do have the ornate box turtle in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. which likes the sandy, drier areas, and it's a type of tortoise mm-hmm. that doesn't need to be in the water at all.
And so for habitats for reptiles, where do we find them?
It really can vary. I mean, anything from like a sand prairie, which is where the box turtle is found, bluff prairies where we have some of our drier snake species, some of our lizard species like the timber rattlesnakes, to the, we have wetland species as well. Some of our garter snakes prefer wetlands. They'll overwinter in the wetland habitat. Hmm. Obviously, a lot of the turtles need that. So it's really quite a range for the reptiles in Wisconsin of what habitats they need.
And as far as geographic locations, are reptiles and amphibians all throughout the state, or are they kind of clustered in certain places? Tara, what about the amphibians?
Well, amphibians, and if I could just add, too, that
sure.
Our amphibians actually also live in quite a wide variety of habitats throughout the state. You can find frogs in forested ponds, small forested ponds, larger wetland complexes, rivers and streams, and even in some of our species actually spend more time away from the water than in the water. So you can find, for example, leopard frogs, especially after they've done their breeding, out in grassier areas.
So they need access to water or wetter areas, but they aren't necessarily spending all their time there.
Right. Almost all of our amphibians do their breeding in the water. So they'll lay their eggs in the water, and then the tadpoles spend their time in the water and then transform into the adults and move on to land. We do, and the same with most of our salamanders. We do have one really interesting, probably my personal favorite salamander is the red-backed salamander.
Okay.
And that salamander actually does not spend any time in the water at all. And so it lays its eggs on dry land and then actually guards its eggs. So you can find them in old decaying logs wrapped up. Protecting their eggs.
Is that what makes them special for you? that they're just a little different?
They're just kind of little and cute, if I may say so.
And that's your professional opinion, of course.
Absolutely. Okay.
Well, so are amphibians throughout the state, even, you know, up in the colder climates up north?
Absolutely. Yep. Okay. We have different frogs and our toad and salamanders throughout the state. Not all of them are everywhere in the mm-hmm. state, but every part of the state has, you know, some sort of a frog or the toad or mm-hmm. salamanders.
Oh. Mm-hmm. And what about the reptiles, Rory?
Yeah, it's pretty much the same, too. I mean, there's at least some reptile that's found throughout the state. We even have some species on the Apostle Islands, on some of the islands, too. So it varies. We have more of our bluff habitats, you know, in the southwestern, west central part of the state. So we tend to see a little bit higher number of some of those species there, but there's a reptile in every area of the state.
Hmm. And has Wisconsin always had reptiles and amphibians? Are these all native species, or are there some that have ended up here one way or another?
The amphibians are all native species. There is some question about the American bullfrog in some parts of the state where it probably has been present in some portions of the state going back in history, but there may be other parts of the state, for example, where it is found now that it didn't used mm-hmm. to be found.
So its range has expanded.
Yeah, so, right.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And reptiles, too? Mostly native?
We pretty much have just native species here. We've had more reports in recent years of red-eared slider turtles, which are common in the pet trade. Mm. And unfortunately, a lot of people will get, you know, a cute little turtle when it's small and it outgrows its aquarium and they need to get rid of it. Instead of finding a good home for it, they release it into the local pond. And the red-eared slider is found just south of Wisconsin. So the climate is close enough that they can survive here.
But they weren't necessarily here historically.
Not necessarily, no. There's still some question as to whether they could be naturally occurring in the very southern portion of the state. Mm-hmm. But generally, most of the species we have in Wisconsin are native. And some of that is just due to our harsh winters, too. You know,
sure.
If we have a turtle that someone releases from Florida,
it's probably not going to make it.
It's not going to make it through the winter, no.
Well, and that brings up an interesting topic. So you were talking about some pet reptiles being released in the wild. What about the reverse? Are people tempted to take amphibians and reptiles out of nature and keep them as pets? And is that a good idea or not? Tara?
Yes. So people, I would say people are tempted to take them from nature. And we do have regulations that talk about what is appropriate and okay to have in possession and not. So just pretty generally, all of our herps are protected in some way. Mm-hmm. However, it is okay to possess some of them in certain numbers for a certain period of time. The species that are endangered or threatened are not something that can be collected or mm-hmm. possessed without a special permit. So there are regulations, and they're there. Those are in place really to protect the species.
Sure.
But, you know, it can be it can be fun, especially for kids, to have, you know, some frog eggs mm-hmm. and keep them for a while and watch them go through their life cycle. And then, you know, when they transform into the adults, they can let them go back into their natural environment. So it can actually be a really good educational experience, mm-hmm. Especially if part of that, I think, is the story that, you know, let's have these and then when they
right.
get big enough,
building an appreciation
right,
and a respect.
Put them
and,
back yeah. in their
some
in
kind
their
of
home.
Ownership, not in the sense of that animal, but like stewardship, I guess,
yes.
you know, of
yep.
nature. And actually, you were just talking about frogs laying eggs and it being an interesting experience. And Amy in Port Wing has a story of her own on that. So let's go to Amy. Hi, Amy.
Hello. So I have a big garden, and I have water catchments. And the tree frog likes to lay its eggs in my water. So then I scoop them out, and I have had some success, but not complete success, of putting them into a bigger container, you know, a different container. And then what I want to know is they need to be fed. So what do they want to be fed? What is the best? Do they want to be in the shade? Do they want to be in the sun?
So basically you're trying to relocate them, but give them what they need to thrive.
Right. Essentially, where I live, there isn't a pond. There isn't a a good water hole mm-hmm. for them that I can just transfer them to.
Which is probably why they liked your rain barrel. And it's funny because Roger Reynolds, who is a guest on our Garden Talk segments quite often, he kind of builds a whole ecosystem, including lots of mulching and composting, and he just started raising basically tree frogs in barrels too. So as part of a healthy ecosystem. So what advice, Tara, would you have for Amy who would rather they're not in her rain barrel, but you know, doesn't want to do them any harm?
Yeah, I'm actually going to let Rory answer
okay.
that one.
All right, Rory.
We're throwing it here.
We have, I guess what I would recommend to her, we have a fair number of people that have problems like this, especially with swimming pools and, you know, even koi ponds that frogs like to lay eggs in. I guess to answer her question specifically, I would try to just mimic the environment that the rain barrel is exactly. So, you know, assuming that the female frog that laid the eggs was picking the habitat that she liked. Mm-hmm. So if she can find an area that, you know, is equal, you know, identical shade and sun mm-hmm. to what she found. The tadpoles, if she has a bit, you know, a bucket obviously won't have enough material for them to eat. But if she can find, a larger, even a pond nearby that she mm-hmm. can put them in, or something that has a little bit of natural environment so that they can get, larvae from insects mm-hmm, to eat. Mm-hmm. They'll eat some plant material as well when they're tadpoles. Something that mimics the rain barrel. And it's, you know, possible that there's not even enough food in the rain barrel.
Right.
So, you know, if there's some kind of screen that she could put over the top of it to prevent it from happening too, that might be good. But in general, when that happens with frogs or even turtle eggs that are laid, we typically just recommend to look at mm-hmm. the habitat that frog chose and to try to mimic that as closely as possible.
Well, and I'm guessing that, you know, we often hear warnings about not having standing water because mosquitoes will lay eggs and things. I'm guessing that those eggs and other insect materials are exactly what the tadpoles are looking for.
Right. And the other thing, too, once those tadpoles transform into adults, and if they are tree frogs, those frogs will be fine. You know, they don't need to be in that water anymore. Mm-hmm. So once they're adults, they can move on and go their merry way and they'll be fine. They'll be able to find what they need.
So it's a pretty short period of time, actually, that they would be in there. But I think your recommendation, Rory, to put some kind of a screen. My rain barrel is actually enclosed, so I don't think I have any frogs in there. Having some kind of a screen. Well, we're going to keep talking about Wisconsin's amphibians and reptiles after a short look at the news. So I hope you'll stay with us. Rory Pulaski and Tara Bergeson from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, our guests. Stay tuned. Hello, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, Wisconsin is home to a large variety of amphibians and reptiles. While not as cuddly as mammals, maybe, or as easy to spot or enjoy as birds, our herptiles are fascinating, and they play a very important role in the ecosystems where they live. Rory Pulaski and Tara Bergeson are conservation biologists with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. They monitor and protect our herps. Are you a fan of reptiles and amphibians? Does the sound of a peeper really signal spring for you? Or maybe the sight of turtles sunning themselves on a log makes your day? I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments by calling 1-800-642-1234 or go to our Facebook page to see some great frog and snake photos taken by listeners or post one of your own. Like the page to get regular updates on upcoming show topics. We'll be right back with Rory and Tara right after this look at the news. Reptiles and amphibians are fascinating to look at, but many of us might not realize that they play an important role in the ecosystems where they live. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Not only is it important to protect their habitats, but we can also attract them to our property and provide them a safe place to live and thrive there as well. Rory Pulaski and Tara Bergeson are conservation biologists with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. They both work with Wisconsin's reptile and amphibian populations and have great information to share. Rory, thanks for being here again.
You're welcome.
And also Tara, thanks for coming in.
Well,
we are going to go back to the phones because we have quite a few people who have questions. Let's go to Sam in Birchwood first. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Judith. I'm so glad you're having this show because reptiles and amphibians are such an interesting and underappreciated part of our outdoor heritage. For my family, looking for snakes and turtles and salamanders is something we really look forward to doing together.
Great.
So, One thing I wanted to suggest was I don't believe Wisconsin has a state reptile, and I've been thinking about this for years. Is I really think we ought to have the fox snake be our state reptile. I'm curious what your guests think of that. And the other thing I wanted to ask was there was recently some move to remove the Blanding's turtle from the threatened species list in Wisconsin, and I was wondering if that has happened and what the guests think about that.
All right, we'll definitely get to the Blanding turtle question in a second, but actually, Sam, I would love to know why the fox snake rises to that level for you, that it should be the state reptile.
Well, there's two good reasons. The first is that it's found statewide. It's one of the few reptiles found statewide. And second is because this snake's range centers on Wisconsin. So roughly one-third of the entire range of the snake is in the state of Wisconsin. We're the only state that it's found throughout. And we probably have half or more of all the fox snakes in the country in Wisconsin. And because it's a really cool, really beautiful, extraordinarily economically beneficial snake.
Well, that was actually three reasons, so yeah. you really made your case. Let's see what Rory and Tara think about that. Rory, do you want to start?
Yeah, well, I would definitely agree. It's a very interesting interesting animal that we have in Wisconsin. And no, we don't have a state in, amphibian or reptile in for Wisconsin. You know, we have state birds, state fossils, you know, minerals. But no, we've never never designated a state amphibian or reptile.
Well, there you go. And do you think the fox snake might be as good as any?
It might be a good one. Yeah. I mean, there's only a couple species in the state that have, you know, that have a lot that are found throughout the state, mm-hmm. and then also have a large portion of their national global range within Wisconsin. So
interesting. Well, that's a great suggestion, Sam. And then Sam also wanted to know about the status of the Blanding turtle.
Yes. So Tara and I both work with the Endangered Resources Program at the DNR, and one of the responsibilities our program has is to look at the status of all of the species in the state, plants and animals, and to make status determinations for those for all of the species, whether they're common, rare. The listed species include endangered and threatened species, and then we also have special concern species, which are rare as well, but they're not quite quite to the point where we are as concerned as the endangered and threatened species, and the special concern species don't have as much legal protection, for sure, as the endangered and threatened species. So, yes, we the Endangered Resources Program is currently in the process of going through a list revision for all of the species in the state. We've looked at the ranks for everything, and the Blanding's turtle is one of the species that we felt was secure enough right now that we are proposing it for delisting. And, you know, it's it. A lot of the turtle populations in Wisconsin have, you know, have some impacts for sure from road mortality. But, you know, even so, the Blanding's turtle definitely seems to be doing well. And we have quite a few locations for that species in the state.
Well, and Tara, it sounds like you're constantly monitoring those lists. So it's not like if an, a turtle or another herp gets moved out of a protected status that they're just kind of like, you know, good luck and, you know, do the best you can, that they're being monitored and their status is being kept tabs on. So if it turns out that they are in more danger or not thriving as well as they would, then the other protections might kick in.
Right. That's true. We're not just going to ignore the Blanding's turtle if it does, in fact, come off of the list. And it's a really good point about continuous monitoring for these species. And it's really important because, you know, if we don't do the long-term check on them, then we really have no way of knowing how they're doing in the state. Mm-hmm. And so we do have several different ways that we do that monitoring. And one of those, maybe we can talk about after a while, is the Wisconsin Frog and Toad Survey.
I'd say let's talk about it right now. We've actually talked quite a bit about citizen monitoring on the show. Owen Boyle was on talking about a whole wide range of different types of activities and projects that average citizens can get involved with. What is going on with the Wisconsin Frog and Toad Survey, and how can people get involved?
Well, the Wisconsin Frog and Toad Survey is a volunteer monitoring effort, and the goal really is to track the trends of Wisconsin's frogs and toad over the long term, to keep track of how the populations are doing and to give us some information about whether or not we should be concerned about any of the populations. So the Frog and Toad Survey was started in 1981 because of concerns about potential observed declines of some of our species, including leopard frogs, and the northern cricket frog and a couple of others. And it is a volunteer program, and so volunteers throughout the state go out every year, and they go and survey ponds, water bodies along roadside routes. There's 10 stops on a route, and they go and they do the same route three different times per year in order to catch the different calling seasons for the frogs, because not all of our frogs are vocalizing at the same time of the year. So it's a great way for citizens to get involved in helping us to monitor and track how our frogs are actually doing out there.
And so you go out, you make your little steps, and then you write up your data and then submit it, and then folks at the DNR kind of pull it all together and see what the trends are.
That's right. Yep. And the nice thing about it, too, I think in general with our frogs and toad, is they're a relatively small group of animals, and so it's pretty easy and doable for someone to actually learn what all the calls are. And in fact, that's what happens on a calling survey, is you're getting out and actually listening for the frogs.
It's an
auditory survey.
So you're not actually trying to spot them,
right?
You're hearing them.
It's done at night, which is when the frogs are generally calling more.
Oh, wow.
So you can learn the calls of the frogs. They're all distinct, and it's pretty easy to learn those calls. You can get CDs or go online and learn which sounds which frogs make. So you go out in the evenings and listen for frogs, and it's a lot of fun. And then most people now are actually submitting their data through an online form. So it's pretty fun. It's a great way for citizens to get involved and learn more about our frogs.
Great. And we do have a link to that on the Facebook page, the Wisconsin Frog and Toad Survey. It's part of the website that is WIATRI.net. So you can go there and get involved. And I assume you could use volunteers anywhere in the state where people are interested.
Yeah, we typically have, try, just to spread out statistically a little bit, we typically try to have 2 to 3 routes per county to do the surveys that we've been doing for the last 30 years. With some, possible changes in climate that we've been seeing recently, we're also starting to look for volunteers that maybe have a pond at their house. And so, that could go out every day, every other day for, several months, but just sit on their back porch for a couple, five minutes.
Cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Or glass of wine of its evening, maybe. Well, that sounds great. And again, that's the Wisconsin Frog and Toad Survey. There's a link on our Facebook page, and the website is www.wiatri.net. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson talking with Rory Pulaski and Tara Bergeson about our state's herptiles. That's our amphibians and reptiles. You can join in by sending an email to talk@wpr.org or calling 1-800-642-1234. And actually, let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Diane in New Berlin. Hi, Diane.
Hi. This is just perfect because I was going to be looking this up today. We have a place in Adams County, and last weekend we had a Eastern Garden Snake sunning itself in the morning and basically in the same spot about 12 hours later in the afternoon. So it leads me to two questions. One is, are they territorial? And the second is, what can we do to encourage it and coexist with it in the area that it's in?
Well, the garter snakes typically aren't a territorial snake. They're actually one of the species that are known to hibernate communally in the winter. So there's actually sites that literally will have hundreds of garter snakes in at the same time. So if you're a snake lover, it's a pretty cool thing to see in the spring.
And if you're not,
you want to avoid their hibernacula.
So any tips for keeping that garter snake that's sharing her spot happy or healthy?
Yeah, one of the main things for the garter snakes, they're pretty much the common garter snakes, which is the same as the Eastern garter snake, can find, they can eat a wide variety of prey. So they can pretty much find food anywhere. One of the best things to do to encourage snakes in an area, and actually is a way that we survey for snakes, is by putting cover objects down on the ground, which for our surveys is a 3/4 inch piece of plywood. The snakes like to use those areas partly for protection, but also early in the morning and late in the day when it's a little bit cooler and the boards typically warm up quicker. You know, any kind of cover object could be good. People have, you know, old shingles, roofing material out, and, you know, you might commonly see snakes under that or tarps. Even wood piles, you know, people see snakes under those a lot. So creating some kind of object like that, that's one of the best ways to attract snakes.
Great. Thanks for calling, Diane, and glad that the program was well-timed for what you wanted to know. We had an email from Anne in Madison. Rory, I think you mentioned earlier that there's a legless lizard in Wisconsin, and Anne would like to know what the difference is between a legless lizard and a snake.
That's a very good question.
Is it eyelids?
No. Yes.
Okay.
One of the things is eyelids. People see legless lizards. They're endangered. The legless lizard is endangered in Wisconsin, so it's not seen that often. But if you look at it closely, there are some differences. And yes, one is eyelids. The lizards can blink. The snakes don't. The lizards also have holes for ears that the snakes would not have if you're up close enough to look at that. And the other thing you might notice, too, if you're handling one of the legless lizards or the snakes, you know, people are typically familiar with the snake's tongue that are, you know, somewhat skinny and forked at the end. The legless lizard, since they're a lizard, they have a little pink tongue like people might see on a gecko. So their tongues are very different if you ever see them eating or are around them very much.
And why would a lizard have developed as a legless lizard?
Well,
it seems like a disadvantage.
Yeah, it would be for a lot of species. The legless lizard that we have in Wisconsin, they're typically fossorial species.
Okay.
So our lizard is primarily found in sandy habitats. It's very easy for them to burrow into.
Hmm.
They overwinter burrowing themselves into the ground. So, you know, when you're spending that much time digging in the ground, it's a hindrance to have the legs
there
on.
Go.
So,
yep. All right. Great. Thank you for that question, Ann. Let's go to Andy in Madison next. Hi, Andy. Hello. All right. Let's go to Ryan in Duluth. Ryan, are you there?
Yeah, hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I've had a common female snapping turtle for about 5 years now. I found her when she was a hatchling. And I've kept her in a 100-gallon tank, and she's getting pretty big. So the past 2 summers, I've had her out in the pond. And I know they hibernate in the wild, and I would never think about releasing her because I know she's... That wouldn't be good. She'd die. But if I can't end up getting her into some sort of aquarium or zoo, eventually when she's, you know, too big to get a tank for, I'm wondering if there's any potential for me to hibernate her in a large pond. You know, I don't know, keeping her longer into the fall or using one of those pond de-icers or something like that.
All right. Well, let's see what our guests have to say. Rory?
Yeah. You know, if you do want to keep the turtle long term, they can survive inside without without overwintering during the winter. The other option, though, is that, you know, unless there's a, you know, the turtle's been kept with a lot of other pet species and there's a concern with disease being spread to the wild. Turtles actually do very well when they're re-released. They just they're very instinctive and, you know, seem to, as soon as you put them back on the landscape, even if they've been in captivity, I've seen for 10 years, you know, it seems like the second they get back out on the landscape, they know
wow.
exactly what to do. So if that's your concern, I wouldn't be concerned, that the turtle wouldn't be able to survive the winter. It just instinctively will know what to do. And letting it go itself and choose its own pond would be good too. You know, if you don't want the turtle shouldn't be freezing in the winter. It typically will burrow underneath, you know, and stay in water that's just about at freezing. So it can be difficult to try to overwinter it yourself in a pond, just making sure you have the exact habitat requirements for it. So again, unless it could be a concern with disease being spread from captive turtles, it would do just fine to release it. The best time of year is probably about now, so it has time to acclimate over the summer, and you're not releasing it right now.
I was going to ask that, so give it a chance to kind of get its bearings,
get its bearings, yes.
and get back and things. Ryan, did that answer your question?
Yeah, that's great news. I thought I was going to have to track down some vacancy at a zoo or something.
All right. Well, thanks for calling, Ryan, and also thanks for being responsible about planning ahead for your turtle. Let's go to Dory in Nishkora. Hi, Dory.
Hi. This is I am totally enjoying your program. What I need to try to get identified is a snake that I had seen on our road. It's a swampy area, and it was about 2.5 feet long, and it had black stripes down its back, or the top portion of them, and then he had little rectangle blue-colored spots all the way kind of down to his tail, and he was very aggressive. He immediately struck, hello?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. He immediately went up in a vertical position and started coming at me. And I just was wondering what kind of snake that might have been.
Sure. Let's see what Rory has to say. Rory?
Well, I'm guessing that it could have been one of the garter snake species, probably a common garter snake. They're typically a black and black color with yellow stripes, or they could look like they have black stripes down their back. And they can have bluish pigment in them sometimes. Actually, some of the species, some of the individuals that are found on Isle Royal are completely black and blue. They have none of the yellow that you would typically see. So the colors can vary a little bit. So I'm guessing that's probably what you saw. And in regards to the aggressiveness, that can be common with any snakes. There's definitely some snakes that are a little bit more docile than others. But, you know, it sees you as something that's going to eat it. So it's, you know, it's really just trying to defend itself and
look as scary
itself.
As it can.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thanks for that call, Dory. And actually, speaking of spotting snakes, there was actually a discovery of a new species of snake in Wisconsin in the fall, the lined snake?
The lined snake.
Tell us about it, Rory.
Yeah, it was very exciting for us. We had a researcher in Wisconsin that we work with a fair amount found the snake. It's on a remnant prairie site in southwestern Wisconsin. And it's a pretty small snake. It kind of looks like, for people that know their snakes, kind of a cross between a brown snake and a garter snake. It's got, you know, dark brownish lines on it. Its belly looks different. It has two rows of black half moon-shaped markings on it. So the species is found. It gets up into northern Illinois and actually southwestern Minnesota, not southeastern Minnesota. And it's more found in the southern part of the country. But again, like the legless lizard that I had mentioned before, it's a pretty fossorial species and thought to be somewhat nocturnal as well. So, you know, it's not, if it's been here for a long time, it's not unusual that people would have either mis-ID'd it or not seen it. But yeah, that was a pretty exciting discovery for us to have in Wisconsin, to have a new snake species in the state.
Oh. And Tara, we were talking earlier about the frog and toad survey, and Jeannie posted on the Facebook page, what great timing. She was hoping we would share that the Rock River Coalition is sponsoring a frog night out at Zaloski Marsh tonight at 7 o'clock. Dr. Josh Kapfer of UW Whitewater's Biology Department is going to teach about amphibians and reptiles likely to be found in the marsh, and then there's a hike and all kinds of things. So people interested in that can probably look at Zaloski Marsh events for Frog Night Out. And you were saying it's a really good way for people to build more of an appreciation and respect for our amphibians.
It really is, and that sounds like a great event.
Doesn't it sound
fun?
Yeah,
it sounds like fun.
What are the ways that amphibians, and I'm guessing reptiles too, but for some reason I have it in my head that maybe more amphibians, are really beneficial to the ecosystems that they're living in?
Well, there's a number of things. One of the things that when I think about amphibians, I think of them as indicators of the health of the environment. And the reason for that is, there's a couple of reasons actually. One is that they have very permeable skin. And so it's pretty easy for things to move through that skin, contaminants in the environment, that sort of thing. And also they have this, most of them, this dual life cycle where they spend part of their time in the water laying eggs and the tadpoles, and then later on the adults are on terrestrial ground. And so they have kind of this double chance to come across things that contaminants, for example. So they can be indicators of the health of the environment. They certainly are prey for other critters, so they're a food source. So you know, they're one part in the whole web and the whole mm-hmm. food chain, and they're really fascinating.
And do they also provide some kind of a, how would I say it, like a cleaning function in wetlands and things like that as they're eating insect larvae or things like that? Do they kind of keep things in balance?
Well, you know, I guess, sure, they keep things in balance. If you mean by cleaning that they're sort of getting bad stuff out, I don't know. You know, they do, certainly they take in contaminants. I don't mm-hmm. know that they, mm-hmm. They don't, they, I guess I wouldn't think of them as filtering that stuff mm-hmm. like a wetland itself would
right,
do.
Right, right. And what about reptiles? What do they, how do they fit into the bigger picture?
Yeah, a lot of it's in a same, you know, similar fashion to as what Tara said. But one of their main benefits too is similar to what one of the previous callers had mentioned, I believe, about the fox snake, that they're, you know, huge predators of a lot of our small mammals in Wisconsin and really keep that population mm-hmm. in check.
Well, we've been talking with Rory Pulaski and Tara Bergeson about our amphibians and reptiles in Wisconsin. They're conservation biologists with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And I just want to make sure in the last minute or so we have here to make sure that people know that they can get involved in monitoring. And Tara, the Wisconsin Frog and Toad Survey is a great way to do that.
Absolutely, yes.
Great. Well, Rory, thanks so much for coming in. And I know we just scratched the surface, but it was great to learn about our reptiles.
Thanks so much for having us.
And Tara, thanks for sharing what you know about our amphibians.
Thank you. It was fun to be here.
We'll definitely have to have you back. Again, you can find out more about that Wisconsin Frog and Toad Survey at www.wiatri.net. Tomorrow at 11, I hope you'll tune in. Rick Cini of faircompare.com will be here with great summer travel advice, including the best luggage to have for air travel. And then at 11:45, we're going to talk with Richard Dolly. He's an outsider who's gained unusual access to the Amish, and he'll share his insights into their communities and ways of life. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, today sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network.